More sparks between the U.S. and India. Today, Friday, January 10th, this is The World. I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman. The diplomat at the center of an ugly spat between India and the U.S. returns to Delhi. Reaction to the case in India runs two ways.
The government certainly sees this as a huge affront to Indian pride. I'm not sure that the public feels as strongly about this as the government does.
Then a look back at 1964 when riots rocked the U.S.-controlled Panama Canal Zone.
We actually had to crawl around because we were being shot at. You're only 19 years old and here you are in combat.
And later a satirist turns a survey on what Muslim women should wear on its head.
A hamburger hat or a hat with had dollar signs on it or a cheerleader image or someone wearing a cowboy hat.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. She's back in India now, but Devyani Kopargade is still smack in the middle of a diplomatic battle between the U.S. and India. She's the Indian diplomat whose arrest last month in New York caused outrage back home. Yesterday, Kopargade was indicted by prosecutors who allege she grossly underpaid her housekeeper and lied about it on U.S. visa forms. But she was also granted full diplomatic immunity by the State Department and then asked to leave the country. Today, India responded by asking the U.S. to remove a diplomat from its embassy in New Delhi. A leader of India's ruling Congress party, P.C. Shako, framed it this way.
We have proved that nobody can take India for granted. Such a thing has never happened. Whether it is America or anybody, India is not going to take things lying down. We have retorted in the strongest measure possible, and that has produced results also. We are happy.
The BBC's Rahul Tandon is in Calcutta. He says the Indian government is more outraged than the general public.
You see, Aaron, I think we have to differentiate between the two here. Look, the government certainly sees this as a huge affront to Indian pride. The reason for that? There's an election in 2014. The government seems to be struggling at the moment. They need to appear to be very strong. Is the public really that affronted about what's going on? I mean, this is a country where, unfortunately, you know, maids are not treated as well as they should be. So I'm not sure that the public feels as strongly about this as the government does, as the clip that you heard there. I think, you know, I'm talking to you from outside a bar. It's a Friday night here in Calcutta at the moment, and I'm not sure that that many Indians really feel that strongly about this case.
Right, Rahul, but doesn't it say something that politicians there feel this is an issue they can use to whip up their constituents?
Yeah, of course it does. Of course it does. And I think, you know, that nationalism is always a strong issue. I think in some ways what it taps into is we talk about India becoming a global superpower, economically at least. And I think that the Indian government wants to have recognition of that. I think that they feel that when the Americans are looking at India, they should look at India as a country which they have a special relationship with, in the same way that they would deal with China, and I suppose historically in the same way that they would deal with the UK. And I think maybe they're using this case to try and force that through, to try and send a message to the wider global community that India is an economic superpower. But I think that if you're talking about a public opinion on this case, you know, if we're moving towards a general election, will it be a key issue there that the government appears to be strong on that? I'm not sure really that the media is really in sync with the way that the public is thinking.
Do you see this, Rahul, as having any kind of long-term impact on diplomatic relations between India and the U.S.?
I suppose the longer that it continues, and if Congress was to win the elections again in 2014 and this row continues to develop and develop, it could have an impact on the relations between the two countries. It is at the moment. Otherwise, we would not be talking about it. And I think that the fact that this has lasted so long gives you an indication of the seriousness, at least on the Indian side, and the way that the Congress government sees this, about how important an issue this is.
The BBC's Rahul Tandon, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you very much indeed.
The spat between India and the United States has seemed at times a little, well, undiplomatic. Nick Burns is professor of the practice of diplomacy and international politics at the Harvard Kennedy School. Nick, let's start at the beginning. Why was Devyani Kopargade picked up in the first place? She was India's deputy consul general in New York. doesn't she have diplomatic immunity?
Well, no, she did not have diplomatic immunity. Not all officials who are in the United States have diplomatic immunity. It depends where you're serving, what your rank is, what your job is. She was not at the Indian Embassy in Washington, D.C. She was the Deputy Consul General at the Indian Consulate in New York City, and she was arrested by U.S. authorities on charges of visa fraud. The allegations are that she made false statements on the visa application for her domestic servant, a woman named Sangeeta Richard.
And it certainly seems that for a non-diplomat, the diplomats have gone a little nuts.
Well, the Indian government retaliated because they charged that she had been subjected to, well, wrongful arrest. They were upset that she'd been subjected to a strip search, that was the allegation, and that she'd been put into a cell with other criminals. And the Indian reaction was very aggressive. It was very emotional and, frankly, excessive because it was really pushed by politics in India. And the Indians retaliated against the United States by removing security barriers in front of the American Embassy in New Delhi and by taking a litany of other restrictions on U.S. diplomats that, frankly, were unwarranted by what had happened because the U.S. had done nothing wrong here.
So after all this fuss, Kobergati was allowed today to leave the country. How does that happen?
Well, she was asked to leave the country. There was a diplomatic compromise of sorts made between the U.S. and Indian governments. The United States agreed that she would be transferred to the United Nations. That was at least for one day, and therefore given immunity because officials attached to the UN do have immunity. But then the United States said, the State Department said immediately, you must leave the country. So she was ordered to leave the country. And at the same time, another branch of the U.S., another part of the U.S. government, the Justice Department, indicted her. So she's back in India. If she returns to the United States at any time in the future, that indictment will stand and she would have to face charges. This is complicating for her because her husband is an American citizen and her kids are American citizens.
So she has not, in essence, been given immunity retroactively.
Well, she was given immunity really as a face-saving gesture, as I see it, to the Indian government as a way to defuse the crisis. And the crisis did need to be dealt with. But the United States did not blink or give in on the legal issue, and so she was indicted. And what's been interesting, Aaron, is that the other person in this story is the domestic servant, Sangeeta Richard. And her case has not been held up by the Indian government or really those commenting in India. In fact, she has been vilified by much of the Indian press and parts of the Indian government. I find that very sad and very tragic because there is a central issue here that domestic servants should be treated honorably and they should be treated obviously they should be given all the protection of the law. And I think that was the point that the U.S. attorney was trying to make.
Another retaliatory measure today, India ordered an American diplomat out of the country and politicians there are saying, the head of the BJP was saying if he had his way, he'd get rid of the ambassador.
Well, it is an election year in India. The BJP opposition leader, Narendra Modi, is someone who's taken a very tough stance on this issue, a very anti-American stance on this issue. I think the Indian politicians have to be a little bit careful here that they don't unduly antagonize the United States. This action today of ordering out an American diplomat was completely unwarranted, and it's unfortunate to see the Indian government take this step.
Ambassador Nicholas Burns, professor of the practice of diplomacy at Harvard University, the Kennedy School there. Nick, thank you so much, as always.
Thanks, Aaron.
There's an image online that's generated some criticism, a few jokes, and in one case, an entirely new visual. It shows the results of a survey conducted by the University of Michigan, which asked residents of 7 Muslim-majority countries how women should dress in public. What's at issue is how the survey was conducted, which was using visual cues. Each respondent was given a card depicting 6 styles of women's headdress and asked to choose the woman most appropriately outfitted for a public place. The 6 styles range from a fully covered woman in a burqa to the less conservative hijab to a woman with no head covering of any type. The results? Most people prefer that a woman completely cover her hair, but not necessarily her face. Lebanese satirist Carl Sharrow, who blogs under the name Carl Remarks, had a strong response to the survey. And Carl, what was your immediate reaction when you saw this visually conducted survey?
I must admit, my first reaction was I was slightly bemused, but also sort of wondered about the usefulness of that image. And also there's a certain type of stereotyping, I think. It's almost putting Muslim women on a scale from 1 to 6, so to speak, from fully covered to not covered at all.
Obviously, I'm not from the region, but I'm having trouble understanding what's wrong with a survey like this. The image we get in the West is, essentially one of these sort of 6 modes of dressing.
Fair enough, I think, for, let's say, an external observer, you get several depictions of women in the media or even through drama. But I think what I found, again, I don't want to say objectionable in the sense I'm not here out to censor anybody or to say this is a form of imperialism that needs to stop. It's not so much that, in as much I think it sheds light on a particular institutional way of regarding other cultures and other people. I think it's almost like looking at catalog and saying which one of these you prefer. And inherently, that exercise is quite reductive. Now, I understand for academic and, let's say, scientific interests, sometimes you have to do these. But you wonder within that context, by definition, by doing that selection process, you've already supplied some of the answers. So you've already created a distorted process. And I personally, I mean, I wouldn't go out to limit anybody's choice in conducting this. Let me state very clearly that I'm all for academic freedom and all for people conducting all sorts of studies. But I wonder about what the usefulness of that is, considering that it already carries a lot of biases within it from the first step before you've even went out and talked to anybody.
Now, Carl, you responded with your own survey and visual, which we'll post online at PRI.org. Tell us about that.
It wasn't really my idea. It was pitched to me by someone called a writer called Yusuf Mnayer. He said, because I do this type of visual spoofs a lot, and I do get requests sometimes now on online. Basically, what he said is, I wonder what would look like if someone were to do a survey, an equivalent survey of American women based on, and here I think his interesting phrasing was, of Arab or Middle Eastern stereotypes of American women. And I thought, well, obviously, the most obvious stereotypes we associate with America, and they're admittedly stereotypes, that was the whole point of the exercise, is fast food, is money, is the cheerleader images.
Yeah.
So they had to be very, very rude, kind of rough stereotypes. And I selected images of 6 women wearing quite absurdly, like a hamburger hat or a hat with had dollar signs on it, or a cheerleader image, or someone wearing a cowboy hat, and then replicated visually exactly the way the image that was accompanied by the Michigan University study, and then had the results distributed rather than my country by U.S. state. So, for example, more people in Texas would prefer the woman wearing the cowboy hat, more people in New York would prefer the woman wearing the dollar signs on her head, and so on and so forth. So that was a way basically of me visually spoofing the image and at the same time kind of saying that stereotypes work both ways.
Carl Sharrow is known online by the name of his blog, Carl Remarks. He's also a practicing architect in London. And Carl, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Aaron.
Coming up, I could say this in a snarky French accent, but I won't, because the French public is being snarky enough over its president's alleged affair. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Health Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World. It's been a rough winter so far in Britain, not as cold as it's been here in the U.S., but a lot stormier than usual, and that's led to a lot of flooding around the British Isles. In fact, flooding is a growing concern for the country as climate change sets in, and that's led the government to start thinking differently about how it protects its coasts. Christopher Wirth has our story as part of our ongoing coverage of rising sea levels around the world.
Do you want to have a little look down here?
Gareth Finney steps inside his 350-year-old pub in Faversham, England, and walks me through the day last month when the sea nearly flooded this old market town, about an hour's train ride east of London.
You can see the devastation as we walk along.
Faversham straddles a creek on the edge of a vast estuary near the North Sea. And in December, this part of Britain saw one of its highest storm surges in 60 years. It left several feet of water in Finney's pub.
The water just came all the way through into our dessert kitchen. We have large oak floor beams, and now the floor needs replacing completely because you can't dry wood out that's that wet.
Finney has reopened for business, but he hopes something can be done so this doesn't happen again.
In order to prevent flooding here on the creek, we need to see some kind of gate put in and divert the surge when necessary.
With global sea levels rising, high storm surges are likely to become a lot more common, which has a lot of Britons questioning the strength of the country's sea defenses. The British government says it expects to spend over $1.5 billion over the next 2 decades, shoring up seawalls and tidal barriers to protect coastal areas. But it's also decided there are some places that it's better letting go of.
Where we're standing at the moment, in an hour or two's time, this will be underwater.
Andrew Gillam is with the UK's Environment Agency. I met him about 100 miles from Faversham on Britain's south coast. Gillam walks to the end of a stone beach with waves roaring in off the English Channel and points to roughly 500 acres of once dry farmland that is now being swallowed by the incoming tide.
The area will become like a large lake full of salt water, and then obviously at low tide that will drain out again.
Gillam's job has always been to essentially prevent flooding, but flooding is just what he wants to have happen here. This stretch of coastline near the town of Selsey is very vulnerable. It was an island before it was connected to the mainland long ago, and the Environment Agency used to go to, well, almost absurd lengths to protect it. Gillam says there was a team of bulldozers at the ready to rebuild the shingle or stone beach whenever it was threatened.
Every high tide, pretty much, if the weather was rough over the winter, they'd be out here for months at a time pushing the shingle back up. So we went past the point that it became realistic to carry on doing that, and that's why we've done something different.
That something different was to buy out the farmers here, build a new earthen seawall further inland, and then punch a big hole in the old shingle beach and let the water come rushing in.
You can see where the grass was, that's now being stripped off by the sea, exposing some of the earth behind, and this whole area is basically going to be a mixture of mudflat, grassland and marshland.
Gillam says the restored flood zone will bear the brunt of future storm surges and rough tides and better protect the surrounding community. It'll also create a new nature reserve. But, of course, you can't just cede land to the sea without stirring some controversy. As sea levels rise, Gillam says there's a natural desire to keep building higher and higher defenses.
But I think we need to move away from thinking that we have to hold every bit of coastline exactly where it is. That's a battle we won't win. We are broadly looking at perhaps up to a metre of sea level rise over the next 100 years, you know, and that would be very significant.
Wilbur.
On the dry side of the new coastline, Chris Howarth, Jill Pearson, and their dogs, Wilbur and Dodie, step out of their old farmhouse. The new seawall runs right outside the couple's kitchen window. And for a while, Howarth says they were afraid their home would be deluged by the English Channel.
For a period of 2 years, there was a huge indecision of whether or not we were in an area that was going to be allowed to flood and we would lose everything.
They did not lose everything. In fact, the changes have made their property easier to insure. But Pearson, who's lived here for 20 years, is sorry to have lost the land she loves beyond the seawall.
Now, when I go down there, the whole place has changed so hugely and everything's unrecognisable. And you'll suddenly see a fence post and think, oh, that's where I am, because otherwise you would have no idea.
Pearson is resigned to the idea that Britain and its coastline must adapt to rising sea levels. She just wishes it wasn't happening in her backyard. For The World, I'm Christopher Wirth near Selsey, England.
Okay, so the president of France may be having an affair. French tabloid magazine Closer had the scoop today. It published photos that it says show President François Hollande riding a scooter with helmet, to an overnight rendezvous with his supposed mistress, an actress named Julie Gayet. Hollande is threatening to sue, though he hasn't denied the alleged affair. But what surprises French journalist Agnès Poirier is that a private affair made headlines in France at all.
30 years ago, nobody would have dared, and certainly not journalists, to reveal that the French president might be having an affair with a French actress. So times have changed. People's opinions about what constitutes privacy or not has also evolved with time. And it is interesting today to hear people talk in the streets of Paris because, of course, you'll find a majority of people thinking, you know, this belongs to the private life of François Hollande. We shouldn't know about it. We don't care about it. What we care about is unemployment, the military operations in Africa. But also you'll find people saying, well, actually, the French president is not an ordinary citizen, and perhaps we should know if he's unhappy and therefore he has an affair with somebody else, because as you may know, his partner, although he's not married, but his partner lives with him at the Élysée Palace. So we get a mixed response, I guess.
You know, Agnes, part of me feels like the distraction is kind of a godsend for Hollande, considering the issues that you talked about.
Well, it is indeed a distraction, but I'm not sure that it is the kind of distraction that President Hollande was wanting. He's very much at a time in his presidency when he has to reassert himself as charismatic, serious, making strong decisions for the French economy. And to see him on pictures frolicking in the streets of Paris on the scooter with just one bodyguard, and also pictures showing a bodyguard with a bag full of croissants at 8 o'clock in the morning the day after, is not necessarily the publicity is looking for.
I wonder if the case of Dominique Strauss-Kahn and his quite public affairs have somehow changed French feeling towards public figures gallivanting about.
In today's revelation about Hollande's alleged affair with that French actress, Dominique Strauss-Kahn is not mentioned at all. You know, he was very much a one-off. What President Hollande is paying, in a way, is the legacy of Nicolas Sarkozy, who was the first French president to break with the tradition of discretion. He staged his private life for political gain, meeting Carla Bruni and having a very public affair with her and then marrying her just after a few months. And Nicolas Sarkozy really broke a French tradition of discretion. And that's what poor President Hollande is paying today.
Journalist Agnès Poirier writes for The Guardian newspaper. Agnes, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter. Ahead, a Somali-American helps a kid back home stay out of harm's way by starting a dry cleaning business in Mogadishu.
This simple service had a really amazing impact. People who would normally not be wearing suits started wearing them.
Plus, a former NBA player with his own history of global activism weighs in on Dennis Rodman.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Health Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's hard to imagine global commerce without the Panama Canal. It's a key international cargo route, especially for companies shipping between the eastern U.S. and Asia. The canal is being expanded now to allow more cargo to pass through. But the project hit a snag, a dispute, not surprisingly, over money. Joining me now is Jason Margolis. And Jason, you've been to the Panama Canal and reported a series of stories on the proposed expansion just a few years ago. First, just tell us what the dispute is about.
Well, as you said, it's about money. A European consortium agreed to expand part of the canal for about $3.2 billion, and now they're saying they will need another $1.5 billion to complete the project. They say the Panama Canal Authority provided poor geological studies, and now it's costing them more to build than the original. originally anticipated. The Panama Canal Authority says, no, we had a deal. And by the way, it's worth noting the European Consortium's bid was the lowest at the time and is actually lower than what the Canal Authority said it would actually cost. So now they're just haggling over money. Who's going to pay for the cost overrun?
Now, $1.5 billion is not chump change, but what happens if they don't resolve the issue? That's it. The construction stops.
Right. No, they can go to arbitration, but if they can't reach a compromise, they'll put out the bid to another contractor. But nobody wants that because that would slow down the project significantly, and time is money.
Now, Jason, you've been there. Paint a picture of the canal for us.
There you go. So a lot of people think it's a long canal. It's not. The passage is about 50 miles, but most of it is ships crossing over a man-made lake. It's really just an amazing engineering feat. So what the ships are doing is they're coming up these three locks. They're raising up 85 feet on the Pacific or the Atlantic, and then they're cruising along this lake, as well as some cut channels. And this is the major trade route from Asia to the east coast of the United States.
And why does it need to be expanded now?
Well, there's two reasons. First, the canal is just too crowded. It can accommodate 43 ships in a day. And there have been times when there are over 115 ships waiting to get through. And the captains of the ships, they do a little analysis. They say, okay, how long can I wait before this starts costing me money to get my goods to where they need to go? And if the wait is longer than 10 days, most will go around the Cape of South America.
Is it really possible to wait 10 days to get through the canal?
Yeah, if it's backed up or if they're doing repairs or something's happening, the wait can be 10 days or longer.
Okay, so the canal might be too crowded. What's the other reason for widening it?
Size constraints. Right now, the locks are 110 feet wide, and that's an important number because there's these ships called Panamax ships, and that means maximum that can fit through the Panama Canal, and they can be 106 feet wide. So it's just amazing when you go to the canal, there's these little locomotives, four on each side, they call them mules, and they're pulling along these Panamax ships with cables tethered to the ships, and they are passing with 24 inches of clearance on each side. It's really, really tight. And now the ships are even bigger. They have these ships called post-Panamax ships, so as the name implies, bigger than the Panama Canal. So the new locks will be 180 feet wide, so significantly wider and longer, allowing these bigger ships to pass.
Man. So what do the post-Panamax ships do right now?
Again, the major trade route is from Asia to the east coast of the United States, or vice versa. And right now, say a ship comes from China, they'll go to Long Beach near Los Angeles. The ships unload the cargo. Cargo goes on trucks or rail, and then they deliver it to Chicago or New York or wherever it's going. And that costs a lot of time, a lot of fuel. It'd be easier just to go right through the Panama Canal if those bigger ships could get there.
So these delays are costing everyone a lot of money, I imagine. Any idea when the project might be completed? When was it supposed to be completed?
It was supposed to be completed the fall of this year. They're already 9 months behind schedule. The Panama Canal Authority says it'll be done in June of 2015. But if the workers stop working, it's anybody's guess.
The World's Jason Margolis, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This week, the people of Panama are remembering the victims of an incident involving the canal 50 years ago. It happened in January 1964. It was the height of the Cold War, and the Panama Canal Zone was still fully controlled by the U.S. then. The zone was, in effect, an American colony, with the U.S. government enforcing its own laws with its own police force. None of that sat well with many Panamanians, and there'd been numerous protests against American control of the waterway. Ashley Byrne has the rest of the story.
Following a series of riots a few years earlier, America had been trying to work out which national flags should be flown in the canal zone. President Eisenhower had ordered both should be flown side by side on the canal zone building. President Kennedy extended this order to include the entire area. But US students objected, and in January 1964, officials ordered no flags should be flown. Angry Americans petitioned that their flag be flown at the Bilbao High School. Panamanian students got wind of it, and on the 9th of January, they entered the school determined to fly their flag too.
There was Panamanian students, about a busload or two of them, that were being held off by a handful of Canal Zone or colonial police.
Jose Ponce, whose father was a Mexican-American and mother Panamanian, lived in the Canal Zone at the time.
The students negotiated that they would leave if they were allowed to come proximity to the American flag pole with the American flag up and then sing their national anthem, and that they would leave. As the Panamanian students started singing, they drowned them out with the American anthem. And then the students decided that, hey, that was unfair, so we want to put our flag up. And there was just simply no way that that demand was going to happen.
This ignited tensions, and in the process, the Panamanian flag was torn. It's still not clear to this day who's to blame for that. The students refused to use buses to take them back into the capital, and Jose followed them as they walked en masse back into Panama City.
The masses were just throwing rocks and throwing stones and throwing Molotov cocktails.
American troops used high-pressure hoses and tear gas to break up these crowds.
By the evening, gunshots could be heard across Panama City. Phil Edmonston was 19 and a young infantry medic on duty that night.
There wasn't much light. I think the worst thing was that you were working in darkness a lot of the time, and we actually had to crawl around because we were being shot at, and there were just bullet holes everywhere. You're only 19 years old, and here you are in combat.
22 Panamanians and 4 U.S. soldiers were killed.
The dead were given a state funeral. President Chiari of Panama was there in person. He later charged the United States with unprovoked armed attack.
The U.S. claimed Panamanians were shot by their own countrymen who had been aiming at U.S. targets, while Panama insisted U.S. soldiers were responsible for all the deaths.
The 9th of January forever will live in my mind, mainly because I saw how a banal incident could translate into not only a change of regime or a change of policy, a change of politics, but a change of a country. And as Mandela was doing what he was doing, and Selma and King, Alabama, and Martin Luther King were doing what they had to do, Panamanians, by accident, changed the history of the country.
In the 1970s, President Carter negotiated a series of treaties giving control of the canal to Panama, which led to the dissolving of the zone over a 20-year period. 50 years on, and Phil Edmonston says the memories of January 1964 are still raw.
Today, if you take a look at what happened then, you can go on the 4th of July Avenue, which was the front lines of the American side and the Panamanian side, and it's been called the Avenida de los Martires now, and you'll see the same bullet holes. They've never been changed. You've got huge bullet holes on the same slum area that exists. There's a constant reminder that there was a battle and that the Panamanians won it.
The students who died 5 decades ago are remembered with a public holiday across the country. The 9th of January is Martyrs' Day in Panama. For The World, I'm Ashley Byrne.
This week in Afghanistan, a 10-year-old girl was detained after what police described as a botched suicide bombing attempt. The girl said her brother tried to get her to walk to a police station while wearing an explosive vest. Headlines about suicide attacks in various countries around are all too common, sadly. Less frequent are stories that explain how a person ends up with explosives attached to their body. We're going to speak now to one man who's been telling such stories. Muhammad Ali is a Somali-American activist. He's made it his mission to help young men and women in Somalia avoid that fate. Muhammad Ali, you are an activist, as we said, talking about what trajectory a young man or woman might take to become a suicide bomber. You've given a TED talk, and in that talk, you speak about something called weighthood. Explain to me what that means.
I think it would be better explained with a story. A young man, for example, from a village outside of Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia, decides to leave his village because of drought, of unemployment, of famine perhaps, and decides to go to Mogadishu for opportunity, for job opportunities. And when he gets there, it's often in the outskirts of Mogadishu he gets stuck in. There are no opportunities. You have this huge influx of unemployed young people moving to the city, and he finds himself essentially stuck, simply waiting. And this is where the idea of waithood comes. And so the way the story normally goes is that he's approached by a dynamic group of people. They give him an opportunity. They give him clothes. They give him food. They give him some employment. And so this, I would say, courting of this young man begins. They slowly ensnare him, and he's slowly brainwashed into believing an ideology. And a few months later, you'll find him in a car bomb, in a suicide vest. And so it's not really clear-cut when it comes to suicide bombings. It's not because these young people have an ideology. It begins with waithood.
You know, in many ways, it sounds like similar situations around the world, gangs in America or anywhere else, you know, prey on kids who don't feel they have any other options.
Right. I mean, kids are at a very vulnerable stage in their life when they're just waiting for an opportunity.
Tell us about some of the people you have worked with.
Until last year, actually, if you wanted to get a suit dry cleaned, you would have to take a flight to Nairobi. There were no dry cleaning services in Mogadishu. So you'll often see government officials or businessmen on their flights out of Mogadishu, where they're going to a conference, having this huge bag of dry cleaning on their way. And if you didn't have $500 to pay for a flight to go to Nairobi, you just didn't buy a suit, or you didn't do any dry cleaning. And so this kid had an idea of starting up this dry cleaning service. He had a bit of capital. With some mentorship, he started up his own business. And within a few months, he was taking in dry cleaning. And I have to tell you, this simple service had a really amazing impact. People who would normally not be wearing suits started wearing them. I mean, there's something special about wearing a freshly pressed suit that kind of makes you stand up a bit taller. And this kid had that impact. I mean, he changed the way people viewed themselves and behaved.
Tell me a little bit about your own story, Mohammed. You were born in Somalia, right? How did you get out?
Yes, I was born in Mogadishu. And during the civil war, my family left, and we moved to Canada and eventually made our way to the U.S. And I was really one of the lucky ones. I mean, I have friends and family members who never left, who passed away during the Civil War, who were involved in these organizations that I spoke about because there were no other opportunities. And so I came to the U.S. I went to college here. I went to Ohio State University, and I eventually decided to go to law school, where I practiced immigration law. My goal was to use my skills and my experience to help people who've gone through the same journey.
Did you say you had family members who were part of al-Shabaab?
Not part of al-Shabaab, but affected by al-Shabaab. They lived in villages near al-Shabaab controlled territories. I had a family member who their son was kidnapped by al-Shabaab. You'll find in these areas al-Shabaab would, for example, forcefully go into schools and kidnap 30 young kids at gunpoint, some of them as young as 10, and they would take them into these training camps where they would give them guns and train them on how to be killers. And so I think the story of that young girl in Afghanistan and the story of young kids in Somalia being involved in terrorism is unfortunately not a unique story.
Mohammed Ali, Somali American activist, a real pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lookout. Lookout is dedicated to helping protect people and businesses from mobile threats, including device loss, malware, and spyware. You can download the Lookout app for Android and iPhone today. Learn more at lookout.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World. One of the big stories we've covered this week is Dennis Rodman's controversial and bizarre foray into diplomacy. The former NBA star has been criticized for going into North Korea to essentially embrace a brutal dictator. Rodman is certainly not the first athlete to take a political stance or even the first NBA player to do so. Several years ago, 6'7" NBA power forward Ira Knubel stepped into a big stakes geopolitical debate over the Darfur-Sudan conflict. Knubel joined other activists like Mia Farrow to try and pressure China to take a more constructive role to help end that conflict. Knubel joins us from his home in Detroit. Ira, you went to Chad in 2007 to visit victims of the conflict in Darfur, Sudan. What was that like for you?
It was a very, very humbling experience. I went there to try to get a pulse and try to understand what was going on. Saw that 400,000 people were murdered and about 2.5 million displaced. And when I started speaking about it, I felt like that I needed to go there and actually see what was going on.
Okay, so at the time, you're a professional athlete, big-time guy in the NBA. Did you think this will be great for my image? What was the motivation?
It started for me just reading a newspaper article about Professor Eric Reeves that was doing some work over there while he was fighting leukemia. And I was watching the news, and I couldn't understand why I didn't see anything about this on the news. So we communicated and decided to come up with just simply writing a letter to the president of China because they were one of the largest economic supporters for that area and the Olympics were coming up. And it was pretty much just going to get my teammates to sign it. I really didn't think it would blow up into what it did, but because of relationships between NBA and China, Nike and China, business relationships, it kind of blew up into something that I really didn't think it would.
Any regrets about what you did? Would you do something differently now?
No, I wouldn't. I have no regrets at all. At the end of the day, I did get support from pretty much majority of the NBA. And what it did is it brought awareness.
How do you think your actions compare to what Dennis Rodman has been doing? Or should we even compare them?
Yeah, I don't think it should be a comparison. I noticed that in an interview, they use the word basketball diplomacy. And I do want to say that I don't believe that's the definition of basketball diplomacy at all. If it is, it's beneficial to Kim Jong-un.
Getting back to your own experiences in activism, in sports activism, what is the biggest takeaway you got from your visit to Chad? And have you kept up that cause or have you moved on to other things?
I have not kept up with it as much lately. You know, I've been working, doing some coaching. But what I did take away from it is, it, like I said at the beginning, it really humbled me and made me understand that there's a lot going on in this world that people don't know about, a lot of pain, a lot of suffering. And all they wanted was some hope and anybody and somebody to help them. And that's what I did, and I got other players to help. So it may not, it didn't stop it, but it helped a lot of people at the time, and it made progress.
That was Ira Knubel, former NBA power forward and basketball diplomat. Finally today, the World Roots Academy in London has flown young British musicians around the globe, not for activism, but to study with masters of traditional music. For the past 4 years, the Academy has showcased these up-and-coming musicians. Last year's concert was the Academy's final one, and it was held at the Royal Albert Hall. Reporter Marissa Neff went to the show and has this profile of one singer.
When 18-year-old singer Fidan Hajieva took the stage at the Royal Albert Hall, it marked the finale of her participation in the 4th annual World Roots Academy. It's a project that was spearheaded by ethnomusicologist and broadcaster Lucy Duran. Duran spent years on BBC Radio 3 showcasing the riches of traditional music from all around the world. Along the way, she realized that there was an opportunity to sustain some of those traditions by bringing young British musicians with immigrant backgrounds back to their family's country of origin. In Fidan Hajieva's case, it was Azerbaijan. The young singer was born there, but moved with her family to London when she was 4. Duran says that made her a perfect candidate for the Academy.
Fidan is definitely a Londoner,
But, you know, she's also very attracted by the culture of her parents, and she loves Azeri music. So we took her to Azerbaijan twice.
Hajieva worked with Gochak Askarov, a renowned singer of Mugam, a highly poetic style of vocal music in Azerbaijan. Hajieva was familiar with the sounds of Mugam, but learning how to sing the complex music posed a challenge. One issue was that she didn't have that much time to study with Askarov in Azerbaijan, so the two turned to technology to make up for when she was back in London.
We practiced over Skype like maybe 3 times a week, which was quite hard because the internet was really bad and there's a 4-hour time difference, but we got it done.
Hajieva forged ahead with the mentorship, and the experience forced her to think about her identity.
Even though I am Azeri, I do see myself as a Londoner, and the living style there was completely different to what I'm used to.
Hajieva says Askarov also asked her to sing Azeri songs that felt more overtly romantic than the pop music she was used to.
My mentor kept on saying, put yourself in that place, like you're in love, you're love struck, and you're talking to her or him. And I was like, okay. He always said you have to feel the music you're singing. So that's what I tried to do. Tried my best.
Before long, Hajieva and her Azeri mentor were poised to take the stage at the Royal Albert Hall. Despite the demands of the musical journey, Hajieva found the performance both emotional and transformative.
Whenever I hear my own culture's music or when I sing, I get goosebumps, and that's what exactly happened on the stage. So that was like, for me, once-in-a-lifetime chance. I hope I can go back and sing there again, maybe one day, but I'm not really sure.
And whether or not Fidan does make it back to the Royal Albert, for one magic night, she filled London's Great Hall with the songs of her homeland. For the world, I'm Marissa Neff.
And that's all for us today. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Aaron Schachter. Have a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Annenberg Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, GatesFoundation.org, the Carnegie Corporation, by the Henry Luce Foundation for Increased Understanding of East and Southeast Asia, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the PRI Program Fund, supporting informed risk-taking in public radio programming, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nor Hall.
PRI, Public Radio International.